May I proceed? May it please the court, I'm Greg Jones for the appellants. The threshold issue, I think, Your Honor, on this entire case has to do with what approach this court will take when expert opinions or expert exhibits are not disclosed. There is, of course, a presumptive sanction of mandatory exclusion that runs throughout the cases throughout the United States, unless the nondisclosure is deemed to be justified or harmless. Courts have dealt with various factors. The key ones are the prejudice to the party opposing the evidence and the ability to cure that prejudice. And in this case, there was no rationale given for the nondisclosure, other than we didn't have to. But what happened was a sequence of steps the court took. And those steps were to reject every possible way the defense could try to circumvent the prejudice associated with the nondisclosure. Let me give you some examples. In light of the nondisclosures, and I trust the court's pretty much familiar with what we're talking about in terms of the nondisclosures, but we tried to have an IME conducted to be able to verify these allegations that were made at the trial. Judge said no.
Doesn't your series of calamities all sort of stem from a failure to have timely objected at the first trial when they didn't provide these documents according to the final scheduling order?
Well, not according to the judge. The judge said that the calamities that you're describing occurred because we had not objected by October 30th, 2010. His whole analysis was that you had to have objected by the close of discovery in October 2010. And that's the catch-22 that we've described. The whole issue is, how would we have objected, how would we have known to object 3 months before the information came to the fore? I'll also mention, too, Your Honor, AMAC says, the AMAC decision talks about what happens at a retrial, and it's a new day. It's a de novo trial. That's what this court has held.
In this, what was new? What was it that you did not know by the end of the of discovery that you say prejudiced you to?
Oh, yes, Your Honor. Well, our brief, of course, goes into and lists in great detail, but I'll give you a number of examples. For example, we didn't know that Dr. Hudson was going to give a disability determination. We didn't know that Dr. Floyd would give a conclusion as to causation for the neck problems. We didn't know he was going to testify about causation for the shoulder problems. We didn't know he was going to talk about the anterior lithesis caused by ligament damage. They didn't tell us about the interpretations of the digital motion x-rays that he testified about. They didn't tell us that he was going to opine about surgery. They didn't tell us that he was going to opine about the cost of surgery. They didn't even tell us about, and this was an interesting concept. He testified at trial over the fact that this man lost an inch and a half of height. There's nothing in the reports that suggests that suggests that conclusion.
Well, I assume you pointed that out trial.
In the briefs?
No, a trial.
Well,
when you cross-examining.
Are you talking about the first trial?
Well,
we couldn't. In the second trial, Your Honor, it was a canned.
Well, but in the whenever you had a chance to cross-examine him, if there's nothing in the record, then you point out to the doctor there's nothing in the record to support what you're saying.
Well, it was more of a disclosure issue, Your Honor. The whole point is on the disclosures that are mandated by Rule 26. We were entitled to know these things before they happened. And in connection with the Dr. Hudson, the MD, his testimony was presented by deposition. That was in the can a few days before the trial began. So I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, but we could not go back and re-question him in trial number two.
Well, no, I know. But when were these opinions expressed? In trial number one, trial number two, or both?
Both.
Okay. So at the trial number one, did you have an opportunity to cross-examine him on those opinions?
We could cross-examine him, but the whole concept behind Rule 26 is that you get to know in advance so you can prepare.
Was he the treating physician, I believe? You're talking about Floyd, right?
Yes, sir. He was a treating physician. He'd seen this man four times. His entire medical records consists of 8 pages.
Did you depose him? I think you're new counsel to the case, but did defense counsel depose him ahead of time?
No reason to. In fact, in the Brooks decision, you'll recall that we rely on, there was no deposition of the adverse doctor either. So it was not incumbent upon us to do that. It was incumbent upon the plaintiff to tell us in advance the basic facts that he would testify to, the opinions he would give.
But when was an objection first raised to allowing this doctor to testify without providing the report?
In the second trial.
That a little late?
No, Your Honor. That's what AMAX shows. And it also goes to the fact, Your Honor, I don't think there's a waiver issue here at all. There can't be a waiver issue because the testimony is being provided in the second trial. Blindsided the first time, absolutely. And the second time, what we tried to do was avert the prejudice. We took what
but,
is...
But how are you... I mean, you had an opportunity. You knew that he had the opinions in the first trial, and you had an opportunity to cross-examine, correct?
We had an opportunity...
Those opinions?
Well, yes, Your Honor, but we didn't know about them until...
Okay. At that time, you might have had... you would have had a lot stronger argument. But by the time of the second trial, you knew he had these opinions.
Absolutely.
And you could prepare for it. If the judge doesn't allow you to take more depositions or whatever, you have some opportunity to respond to him with your own evidence. Correct?
Well, see, that's you're absolutely right. You would think that. But we didn't. We tried that, Your Honor. We tried to do an IME. He said no. We tried to call a witness to rebut these new ideas. An orthopedic surgeon, the judge said no. We tried to do a radiologist, the judge said no. We said, well, Your Honor, at least don't let them testify about these things that they didn't reveal to us. The judge said no. And then, 2 days before trial, they whip out these. This is one of three that was done. And we said, well, Judge, you've denied us the right to call and rebut these witnesses. Now we don't have a witness to rebut what came here. And we said it should be kept out because it was not disclosed as required by both the scheduling order by Rule 26, and the judge said no. We would have had witnesses, if they'd let us do it, to testify. It's not in the radiology. It's not supported by the radiology. And what we ended up having is getting blindsided at both trials, two different ways, one with a sequence of exhibits like this that were used in opening statement during the course of Dr. Hudson's testimony and at the end of the closing statements.
And what was the basis of Judge Hendren's rulings, that you were late to the game or to the dance, or were you, or did the rule not require that which you thought it required?
If you're referring to the diagrams,
yes.
Illustrates, what he said was, what the plaintiff said, was that, oh, these are merely demonstrative, and therefore I'll let him call it. Well, the judge realized after they started using them that they were not merely demonstrative. And so, with all due respect, he concluded that they were merely demonstrative, and on that basis he let it. There's case law that says, well, that isn't enough. If you're going to have your experts use even, quote, demonstrative testimony, that's the Leckis decision we cited, you have to disclose them. And they didn't. And they didn't provide a basis for us to get ready for and respond to. All we could do was sort of flail about, Your Honor. When you get it 2 days in advance, there's no way for you to prepare this. Fortunately, FFE had halfway decent lawyers, but they're not doctors. And to be able to rebut this last-minute stuff for the second time around just crippled us. We had no witnesses to present at trial because of the judge's ruling. The litany of things, it's listed in the record. The trial transcript at 127 talks about that inch and a half loss of height. There are all kinds of references in the records to what we would have done. had we been able to do it. The whole point is the cases from throughout talk about what prejudice is there to the party opposing the evidence and what steps you could have done. The judge did not consider any of those options. And that's the quintessence of an abuse of discretion. All he did was say, well, it's too late. It's too late to object because you should have objected back in by the time of the discovery deadline, 3 months before we learned about the new testimony, the new testimony and the new exhibits. Actually, 15 months before we learned about the new exhibits. That's the essence of the problem. The judge just did not engage in the analysis that the courts say you have to if you're going to deviate from the presumptive mandatory preclusion rule. He didn't do it. Your Honor, the testimony that we could have put in is extensive. For example, Dr. McAllister would have said there was no evidence of torn ligaments. That was a key issue. That there was no evidence of this ligamentous laxity. That there was no nerve root or cord compression. Dr. Peoples would have gone through a whole variety of things. Their reports are in the record. I'm going to sit down unless the court has some questions at the moment and reserve the balance of my time.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Cheney.
Morning, Your Honor. The gravamen of FFE's complaint in this case is they had no witnesses to rebut medical testimony and routine medical visual aids. But that's simply not true. FFE identified an expert before the first trial of this matter. His name is Dr. Bernie McCaskill. He's an orthopedic surgeon at Presbyterian Memorial Hospital, I believe is the name of it, in Dallas. By agreement, the parties took a deposition of Dr. McCaskill and a deposition of Dr. Floyd, both of which were intended to be played at the trial of the matter. Those depositions were conducted by agreement of the parties. And if you look at what Dr. McCaskill reviewed, he gave the same opinions that Dr. Floyd did. This is in the record. It's in his deposition is attached to the record. It's in FFE's appendix around 431 to 439. And he testifies that he doesn't dispute the imaging findings. He doesn't dispute the 25% permanent impairment rating that Dr. Hudson talked about that was in one of the medical records. He also gave an opinion that was supported by data from the Texas Department of Health for his own hospital about what the cost of shoulder and neck surgery would be. So FFE's own expert, before the first trial even took place, talked about all the things that FFE is now objecting to.
Was Dr. McCaskill's testimony used at the trial, second trial?
Your Honor, they identified Dr. McCaskill as a witness. They made designations. Both sides did. We took it. It was a video deposition. So both sides made designations. Importantly, in the designations, there were no objections made to timeliness for Dr. McCaskill or for Dr. Floyd. So he's designated in voir dire when the judge permitted FFE to tell who their witnesses were going to be. They identified Dr. McCaskill as a witness. And so the trial starts on a Monday, and we go through the week, and the judge had to take a half day off to go to an investiture that week. And so we get along to Friday morning, and it's time to fish or cut bait. So when it's FFE's turn to present their case, they think, hey, we'll let a jury deliberate on Friday afternoon. They want to go home and get this over with. It was either a tactical decision to have the jury deliberate late on Friday afternoon, or FFE didn't like what he had to say in his deposition.
Was there any, I don't remember what all of them were in the briefs or what Mr. Jones just said, but there were any of the opinions that the FFE's raising now that were not addressed by Mr. McCaskill?
Dr. McCaskill equivocated on causation. But he talked around it, but he wouldn't really specifically say when he was pressed during cross-examination. For instance, he said, and the real injuries in the case are in the neck and the upper cervical area, and they're torn spinal ligaments. And he said if somebody has a legitimate segmental instability as a result of a specific injury that's not present before the injury, then yes, they are more significantly injured. And that's the same opinion Dr. Floyd gave in his deposition a couple of days later. Now, he talks later in his deposition, and he says, after the treatment I've talked about earlier, which could be 6 to 8 weeks or even longer, and I'm not trying to lump Mr. Bradshaw into the 6 or 8 week treatment timeline, but if someone is still having problems after that course of treatment, and that individual did have a traumatic instability as a result of a specific traumatic event, the only additional thing that might make a difference would be an operation. So even he's saying, if he's got these problems, then an operation might be necessary. Now, there's one other thing that he's asked that goes towards the causation area, and he says, the question is, if an injury victim has some degenerative change that's a pre-existing condition, what effect would that have if there were significant motor vehicle collision trauma applied to that area of the body? And his response is, I think a person that has a pre-existing degenerative condition and is exposed to trauma is more likely to be symptomatic than someone who didn't have the pre-existing degenerative condition. And that goes hand in hand with what Dr. Floyd said. So it's not about not having an expert to rebut opinions, or maybe it is. They didn't like what their expert had to say because it didn't rebut Dr. Floyd's.
Were these experts decisions deposed after the end of discovery?
Yes, sir, by agreement.
So they were caught with probably inability to disclose another expert. Is that what your side argument is?
Well, that's not what his report said, but he fell apart under cross-examination.
Well, that's what I mean. They had disclosed one expert when the depositions were taken after the end of discovery. Your argument is the expert didn't support with their position, and it was too late for them to go get another expert.
The trial was starting in a week or two after the depositions.
What about these exhibits? Like this, I don't know what it is, and I don't care to know what it is, but my point is, why is that come up late and is maybe more than demonstrative?
Your Honor, I don't believe that this is anything more than a visual aid. It's a pedagogic device. It's something that the doctor uses to explain what this terminology means to the jury. It gives them a visual aid to understand complex medical terminology. Your average juror is not going to know what a left and right transverse ligament is.
Why was it not disclosed shortly before trial?
Your Honor, I'm going to answer your question, but I'm going to point to something that's in the record to do so. This is a routine way trial practice is handled for visual aids. If you look in the record, FFE wanted to use Dr. Peoples. They knew what his opinions were going to be because he gives the same opinions in every case. And So they provided a report to him that wound up being excluded. And it's funny because in that report, it's produced about, I don't know, 5 weeks before trial. And on the very first page, it says...
Or the first or second trial.
Second trial. I appreciate the clarification. His report says, if I'm called to testify live, I may use anatomic models or drawings to help explain my findings and opinion to a jury. That's what his report says that's dated 5 weeks before trial. There are no anatomic drawings or visual aids attached to his report. It's the common practice of the way trials are conducted. So it's unfair for FFE to claim that, oh, your visual aids were late, and then want to use the same type of visual aids in its own trial. It all comes...
Well, I could see you would run a risk. I don't think trial judges, and maybe most trial judges, would not have allowed that, your exhibits coming in late. But I guess your argument is, well, that's within the discretion of the trial judge, and we were able to convince the trial judge to use it. I assume that's your argument, right?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Both of these issues that FFE is raising on appeal are within the discretion of the trial judge. And he was right on these decisions. He, in his gatekeeper role, looked at the visual aids and said, he's got a choice to make. Is this going to be misleading to the jury, or is this going to be helpful for them to understand complex medical testimony? And he's the one calling those balls and strikes. It's the trial court. He's the gatekeeper. And he thinks that because there's some language that ordinary jurors will probably not understand,
yeah, but there's another issue. What the defendant is saying is, yeah, that's all true, but you were lying in the weeds and surprised them with this, and they weren't prepared for it. That goes to the trial judge's discretion about ordering the trial, saying, you know, we have certain times when you have to show your exhibits, put your cards on the table, and the defense, FFE, saying you didn't do this until it was too late. I don't hear him saying that this exhibit had been disclosed earlier would have been wrong. It was just that you surprised him.
I think they're absolutely saying it would have been improper. I think they're wrong about that because they're citing to videotapes from automobile crash reconstruction cases. I think they're wrong about that, but they are making that argument.
Well, but that's what makes trials is both sides are arguing about the relevance and the accuracy of the exhibits. But to me, anyway, their best argument, and I think it's their argument, is, well, wait a minute, you sprung this on us when we didn't have enough chance to respond.
Well, that goes to prejudice, Your Honor. And there's no prejudice here because these boards were not admitted into evidence. They were just used as a visual aid during trial. And there are two exhibits that directly support what is put on these boards. There's an MRI report that makes these findings, and there is an X-ray measurement report that shows the findings on one of the other boards. So it's not like this information is not in evidence at all. And they had that long before the discovery deadline in the original case. I want to go back to what we were talking about with the doctors briefly. Dr. McCaskill was an orthopedic surgeon, is an orthopedic surgeon. That's what Dr. Peoples is. I can understand why they wanted to replace Dr. McCaskill with Dr. Peoples, but...
Well, let me ask it this way. Why is it fair to allow you to put on experts who have not provided a report? They discover at the first trial essentially what the opinions are. They then find two experts to rebut that, and then they're excluded from that. Why is that a fair process?
Well, Your Honor, let's talk about our two experts. We have Dr. Hudson, who testified. He had extensive medical records. He gave two reports, not just one report, two detailed reports in his medical records about what his opinions were on causation. He testified that future treatment would be needed. He testified that his report said that the injury was permanent. So Dr. Hudson gave a report. Really, the report issue is with Dr. Floyd. And before the first trial, 2 days after Dr. Floyd's deposition had been completed, FFE produced a bunch of information to us that they wanted to use at the first trial. And a bunch of it we had never seen before. There was a witness on the witness list that had never been disclosed. And there were numerous exhibits. And this is it in Bradshaw's appendix at 394 to 96. So I wrote an email to the former counsel for FFE and said, you know, you're accusing us of nondisclosure. Well, look at all this stuff you didn't disclose. There are two ways we can approach this. One is we can have a whole bunch of objections at trial about what is disclosed and what wasn't disclosed, and that's just going to make the judge and the jury mad at us. Or we can agree to waive the objections that could have been raised to disclosures before February 11th, 2011. And so both expert depositions have already been taken at this point. All these new documents from FFE have come in. There are some medical records after the discovery deadline from when Mr. Bradshaw continued to seek treatment. And so they agree. They said, we need to use this stuff. So in light of that, here's what I want to use. And that's the way we went with it. So
is that in exchange in the record?
Yes, sir. It is at Bradshaw Appendix 394 to 96.
I'm sorry, it's when?
It's in Bradshaw's Appendix 394 to 96.
That cooperation agreement must have fallen apart before the second trial then, because you then did object to them bringing in new expert witnesses.
Well, it was new experts. And there's some discussion about, in FFE's brief, about us agreeing to an IME and then backing off on that. And that's not what happened. Mr. Jones and I had a case together in state court set for trial about six or 8 months before this one went off. And he forced our client to go through an IME with Dr. Peoples. And so there was no confusion between the two of us about who he wanted to use for an IME. We knew it was going to be Dr. Peoples. And this is all on the record, but he is a professional defense expert. There's no other way around it. He's testified in 100 cases in the past 4 or 5 years. And so I've been trying in other cases to get additional bias information out of him. And I offered to let Dr. Peoples participate in this case if he would produce some of that information. He didn't agree, or FFE wouldn't agree, and so we objected.
Okay, your time's expired. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Permit me to respond to some of the questions that were raised. As far as what Dr. McAllister could not address, he could not have addressed this loss of 1.5 inches of height. He didn't know about it. It didn't come out to us until after his deposition was taken. Number two, he couldn't testify about cost of surgery in Arkansas. He's a Texas doctor, not an Arkansas doctor. At the time he was brought in and to testify, there was no proof in the record that they were going to be asking for surgery, much less the cost of surgery. So there we were with a witness who could not address a key issue that they raised. He could not address, as I say, the cost of surgery. He could not address the diagrams, obviously, that didn't come up until later. So
what? What was that last one you said?
He could not address the diagrams that did not come up until later, obviously. As far as I think the question was raised about the nature of these diagrams, this court and other courts have recognized the difference between substantive and demonstrative evidence. Even if this were construed merely as demonstrative, even if it would, could be.
Is there an instruction either at the time or in the closing or opening instructions about demonstrative or illustrative exhibits?
There was the judge when it at one point did tell the jury that this is merely demonstrative. And what's interesting about the record as you look through it is that he later called all of us up to the bench and said, basically, I don't know if it's chastised plaintiff's counsel, but he says, you're not using this the way that you told me you're going to use it. It became demonstrative is, for example, a skeleton, a generic skeleton. And that's what, if he'd been able to do it, Dr. Peoples would have used in conjunction with his testimony. That's demonstrative. It's generic. It's not specific. When you move to the specific, just like in the reconstruction cases of accidents, if you try to recreate the actual accident, that's considered substantive.
Was it made clear that this was not an X-ray or a photo of the actual plaintiff?
It was made clear by Dr. Hudson that this properly discloses the nature of this man's condition.
You're going to have to stay close to the mic or we're can't
I apologize.
Record you.
I should have left it earlier. It was made clear through counsel and through Dr. Hudson that this was intended to be a replication of this man's condition. So the flip side of what you just said, Your Honor, they stressed that, and they used it in opening, direct, and closing statements. As far as the various issues, I think that's pretty much it. Unless you have additional questions, I'm going to give you back your 18 seconds of time.
Always appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. We thank you for your arguments, your briefs, and your oral arguments, and we will take it under advisement and be back to you in due course. Thank you very much. Thank you.